Today, when we think of politics, for most of us, friendship is not the first thing that comes to mind. Our politics are rancorous, ugly, polarized, and just about everything else politics is not supposed to be. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. In spite of the rancorous, ugly, polarized politics of ancient Athens, Aristotle suggested that what holds cities together, that is, the thing that is at the root of politics, is friendship. At June's Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Dr. Virginia Arbery looked at friendship and politics using The Politics by Aristotle. Here's what she had to say.
So we're trying to connect this evening the intimate connection, the integral meaning of friendship and city. And we're not used to thinking about the Greek polis, the city, as a guide to what politics should be. We're so used to thinking, aren't we, of politics as self-preservation, perhaps power on the part of some over others. But to think about our natures, as Dr. Papadopoulos invited us to do when he looked at the ethics with us, to think about our natures as being completed together in community. That word on your little handout, koinonia, association, partnership, community. And then to think about levels of association or partnership or community that culminate, that come to their fruition in the city, the most complete of associations. And with Aristotle, as you know from the very first chapter of the first book of his Politics, everything is a building block. Parts are in relation to the whole. The whole is the end for which the part is designed. And you can't understand the part without seeing the end. And so we have that provocative sentence, the city is prior to the household, that most fundamental association that begins with a man and a woman. So to even think about politics in terms of partnerships or communities or associations is already to think in terms of friendship. We might look together to just see explicitly again at a passage that we looked at when we did the ethics on page 144 of book 8. And friendship seems to hold cities together. And lawmakers seem to take it more seriously than justice. We talked about this. For like-mindedness seems to be something similar to friendship. And they aim at this most of all and banish faction most of all for being hostile to it. And we've seen faction, haven't we? We've saw it already in the army of the Israelites under the king Solomon. We saw alliances in terms of favoring David over Saul. We saw faction in the Achaean army between Achilles and Agamemnon. We saw faction in a sense in the difficulties in Ithaca with those young men bonding together to get the queen, and this problem that we didn't discuss, but which is there very much on Odysseus's mind, is what are we going to do about the division on the island of Ithaca after we've had our reunion? Now we have to reunite the city, which is full of very angry fathers, right? The aristocracy of the city. So we've seen this terrible disease of cities, of any political order, faction. I don't know if you looked at the paper the last couple of days. I know I have a stack I need to look at. They always come a day late in Lander, so I never feel that bad about it anyway. But when I get to my Wall Street Journal, I saw the other one, I guess it was Monday's, and it was the sea of people in Hong Kong, million or more, protesting Beijing, China insisting that all legal cases, if they want, can be tried among the Hong Kong citizens in China. Well, you know what that means, no real justice. And so we have this terrible uprising. We see, we could even say, percolating faction within our own regime. Certainly, we hope we won't have another civil war. Our marriage has resolved that problem, by the way. I'm from Illinois, the land of Lincoln, and Glenn is from the secession state of South Carolina. So long before it became fashionable to say transsexual, we've been transsectional. And so he goes on to say, and when people are friends, there is no need of justice. Right? But when they are just, there is still a need of friendship. And among things that are just, which inclines toward friendship, seems that which inclines toward justice seems to be most just of all. And then this word that we keep seeing in this lovely translation from Joe Sachs, did he teach you at St. John's, Dr. Papadopoulos? It was a wonderful, wonderful translation. I love it. It's a little slow, but it gets at the meaning of these words. And friendship is not only necessary, but also beautiful. For we praise those who love their friends. An abundance of friends seems to be one of the beautiful things. Moreover, people believe that it is the same people who are good men and friends, both together. So it's a very important passage, and it establishes the political integral bond to friendship. And then a little bit later on 71, just to review this wonderful point that was brought to our attention in the reading that Dr. Papadopoulos emphasized, and that of self-love, the idea of self-love. Being a lover of self, which isn't the same thing as being an egotist. He was very clear to point that out. So the kind of self-lover that we find reprehensible, let me just distinguish that again. It is not unclear that most people are accustomed to mean by self-lovers those who distribute such things to themselves, right? The things that are external goods. For if someone were always eager to do what is just or what is temperate, himself most of all, or to do anything else, whatever that is in accord with the virtues, and in general were to save up for himself what is beautiful to do, no one would say he was a lover of self or blame him. Now, if that were the real definition of self-love, we wouldn't blame him for being selfish. So that idea of distributing such things to themselves, what are the things that are distributed that are worth admiring in the city? What are the honors? That word time we talked about a little bit when we talked about Briseis being taken from Achilles by Agamemnon. What are the honors, though, that are due to the good man, the one who is not divided, one with himself? In a way, that's the way we're supposed to think about the good city, in the same way we think about the good man, that there's no division in the city with respect to the good things we should want as human beings, the advantageous, right, and the just. We should have a common good in mind, and that one good that in the human being is ruled by reason over the passion, and the city is also reflected by choosing rulers who look to that highest part of man rather than just satisfying the appetite. So giving honor to the right things within ourselves is really self-love, and then honoring the right things in the city is having a city in friendship with itself that doesn't result in faction. So those are a few things I wanted to remind us of before moving on, because they establish this two-part work, the ethics and the politics, which are of a piece in Aristotle's own mind, the first dealing with moral nobility, which is the study of the virtues, right, with friendship being even higher than justice, right, and then the second being justice itself, the work of the politics. How do we, and this is the problem, as we know from book one, how do we distribute honors rightly according to those who deserve them, who merit them? And there's a lot of debate about how we do that. If you look at your handout, you'll see part of the problem. First of all, you have to decide who's going to share in what and how much, if anything. This is from Politics Book 2, which we didn't read. It is necessary that all the citizens share in everything or nothing or in some things, but in not others, for it is possible for the citizens to share with one another in respect to children and women and possessions, as in the Republic of Plato. And he says, no, that's a bad idea. Let's not share the women and the children. I mean, that's an interesting idea. Our students confront it with horror when they read the Republic Book 5. But it's a possibility, right? Spartans have some connection with this idea of Plato's Socrates. So you have to make a distinction among whether everything is shared to have this unity in the city so that you don't have faction, which results in enemies and the loss of friendship, nothing or in some things, but not in others, right? So part of the debate is going to be if you're making the right distribution between quantity and quality. Aristotle's wonderfully specific. I just love his interest in detail. You know, he doesn't just map a theory. He goes through, as he does in the Ethics, opinions about what the city should be. And he goes through ideas of good cities in Book 2, which we didn't look at. And then he looks at, you know, just the logical, observable elements in most any city for it to be self-sufficient. So for a city to be self-sufficient, to be one that leads toward man's proper end of happiness, you have to have not only number, the multitude, right, but you also have freedom, wealth, education, probably some with good birth, right? So how do you jockey and distribute offices with respect to those qualities? How do you distribute offices, maybe the judicial branch, as we call it, or the jury, as Plato talked about it, among the multitude? How do you distribute these things so that everybody has a stake, is part of the partnership, and feels as though this is my city? It's not the city of just the wealthy and the well-educated. It's my city. I care about it, right? I care about it in a way that is larger than my own self-interest. This is the political problem, and that distribution done well results in a just city, done poorly results in an unjust city that could result in its own dissolutionment. Okay, so the challenge for us, as we know, as moderns who've inherited not only Aristotle but some other thinkers, modern social contract thinkers, is to think about the city in this way, where justice and friendship and the soul formation that goes along with the preservation of justice and friendship become the object. As you knew from the end of Book 1, let's look at it together real quickly. The very end of Book 1, what is he talking about there from about line 10 to 20? He goes back to the beginning, you know, the relationship between the husband and the wife and the children, that whole household, right? These things of the household. One should look at the virtue of the part in relation to the virtue of the whole. Both children and women must necessarily be educated looking to the regime, at least if it makes any difference with a view to the city's being excellent, that both its children and its women are excellent. And then he goes on to talk about, you know, well, the women make up half the persons. The children will be those who are partners in the regime. You've got to care about. So the education for the regime is the education for that decision that one has made as part of that common bond in the city of really not just who should rule, but what the best life is, right? The answer to the question of regime. We talk about regime in a way that has kind of got little red terror signals that come up, the red, you know, communist regime. No, but just erase that from your mind. Right? I had a friend, anytime you said anything bad about anybody, which I loved to do because you know how little think tanks are. We were in a think tank, and she'd say, erase that thought, Jenny, just erase it. How do I erase that thought? It was okay. Hey, erase that thought. So erase that thought about regime. It's not the way you should think about it. But it's this answer to the question, who should rule? And the answer is absolutely of a piece with what kind of life do we want to live? What kind of human beings do we want to be? So each regime, whether it's kingship or aristocracy, or what he calls a mixed polity, a combination of oligarchy and democracy, whatever that good regime is going to look to a proper end of our being human. Nobility, if you're in the aristocratic, maybe wisdom, in the order of kingship for the best kingship. And then moderation, if you have a mixed polity that balances the interests of the few wealthy against the many who are less than wealthy. So, regime is about soul formation, and education, as we see at the end of book one, is the business of each household, education in the regime. Not education, I know this is kind of hard for some of us, in, let's say, well, as we know from the end of book one, how to be a practically successful young man, and I'm going to send you to Harvard or Princeton where all the best salaries come out of, right? And I'm going to prep you for that position in the world. No, that would be a denial of the proper role of the household, right? The household should be interested in soul formation for a good regime that's not looking for inordinate wealth, right, but actually for a moderate soul that might actually result then in prudent men, prudent citizens. Now every regime, as you know from this little section of book one, begins with these small elements. Now he wants to get out of the way a certain kind of argument about what makes ruling, how one can rule. What is all ruling the same, right? This is an interesting question. And it actually, in posing it, he is calling into question his friend Socrates, but we know, of course, Aristotle's gonna put truth ahead of his friendship here, right? About ruling. Is political rule the same as household rule, the same as mastery over slaves? So there's a qualitative difference. You can't put these all the same just because they're ruling. What's required in the monarchical is you want to obey the one who's wise, right? And of course we know from his discussion of children, both in the ethics and here, that children are potentially capable of friendship as citizens in the city, but they're not yet, right? So obedience is not what you want in the city. You want a participation in the decision making, right? The deliberative, this is what makes you free, right? To be a thinking being who then makes the choices upon which one acts, one hopes towards the right ends. So we have to distinguish this in the back of the mind. Of course, he's thinking of what others say. Now, the rule that he talks about in the household, he says, for the sake of reproduction. Now, I don't know what some of you ladies thought about the explanation that he gives here. that the man would like to make a replica of himself, something to that effect. I mean, I only have one experience of being proposed to, but I don't remember Glenn ever saying, Jenny, will you marry me? I want to have other images of myself in the world. Just so perfect. Well, it's the animal order, though, that seems to dictate many of his observations about the human order, which is very sobering. Right? I mean, everybody reads John Paul II and wants to talk about the theology of the body, and it gets way up here really fast, right? But Aristotle starts to say, well, this is what the animals do, and, you know, there's something sobering in thinking about this fundamental relationship. It doesn't end here. His description, you know, their beautiful passage is actually in the Ethic, where you see friendship between man and wife as being very important. In fact, he says it can be one of the highest friendships if, in fact, they're looking toward the same good together, right? Not just because they have common interests, and not just because the man would like to leave behind another that is like himself, but the most possibility that one could hope for is there, he would suggest. But to start with the animal is important because it's important in setting up the distinctive human feature. So this all sounds good. Thank you, that's very helpful. As a kind of progression from the simplest, the husband and the wife, to the master-slave and then the children that he's described. And then once you have the household, then you have villages of households, and then you have several villages together that come and make a complete self-sufficient life that will be the city, full self-sufficiency, not just for the sake of living, as he says on the top of 37, but for the sake of living well. And that's an open question yet, what that might mean. So it looks as though it's all going to have to happen, this social relationship, naturally, because it begins with associations and it will end with the most complete association, the city. And yet on the bottom of page 37, he says something very interesting, which has implications for friendship as well. But he says, accordingly, there is in everyone by nature an impulse toward this sort of partnership. So we're moved into it, as it were, by a magnet. We're attracted to being social. We're not forced into it by necessity, but we're naturally moved into it. Right? And yet the one who first constituted a city is responsible for the greatest of goods. And you go, huh? Well, was it by nature or was it by institution that we had a city? Just came from a Liberty Fund, which is a group of people talking together about common texts, and arrived Sunday night, that's why I missed all of you, but oh, it was on Friedrich Hayek and his writings on free market economy. And he's particularly interested in fighting socialism when he's writing from the 30s through the 70s. And then we also read George Bernard Shaw, who's a socialist, and read his saw his plays, read many of his tracts on socialism. And I didn't see any difference in the thought of Hayek, who's kind of a hero of free market people, and George Bernard Shaw, who's, you know, when the AOC resurrects him from her pile of books that she never read, maybe she'll see what her roots are intellectually, but I saw no difference in their understanding of man, because the whole approach for some time now to politics is that we evolve to have reason, we evolve to be social. It's by chance, in some cases, that speech comes about. It's not natural to us, right? And that when we do have cities, it's either by an explicit agreement, in the case of the social contract thinkers, or it's by spontaneous order, is what Hayek says. But to have a mind that's cooperating with the sense of the group and knows how to bring it into a form, yeah, that seems to be a blessing for Aristotle, right? We have founders. They think about what the relation is between the form of our regime and the people, what they're capable of, you see. This is a recognition that is not there in the modern. Okay, one last thing. He brought up that word gentlemanliness, and I'll end with this. And it's a magnificent word in Greek. It includes this idea of the beautiful kalon, which is often translated finely or nobly, but the beautiful is calling us to it. It comes from the word to call. So the word gentleman combines the beautiful and kalos kai gathos, and the good, the agathon. So the gentleman is the beautiful and the good man. And this seems to me, now this is a much longer discussion, but this seems to me to be what the aim of the good political order is. If you have a good regime, you're looking to form citizens who are gentlemen. And we're not thinking here just of a certain mannered Englishman in Jane Austen's novel, although it might be Mr. Darcy. Could be, yeah. The beautiful and the good man, right? The virtuous man. It's not an aim that we think of in political life anymore, but it's clearly what he's talking about and introducing here, and then works through in his structural arguments about how to get a city that will approximate the formation of that kind of man. Okay, thank you. You all get some sleep tonight.
In an interview about his book, The Death of Politics, Ethics and Public Policy Center scholar Peter Wehner comments, "We have to rethink our attitude toward one another and toward the pursuit of truth. It's not simply recognizing that people who hold different views than we do aren't by definition stupid, corrupt, wicked, or malicious. It's that we come to a place where we believe we might have something to learn, or at least something to consider, from those whose views and outlooks and life experience are different than mine. That's never easy to do, and it's harder to do in this environment than at any time I can recall." Close quote. That is, our calling as Christians in this and every age is to friendship, the bedrock of culture, society, and politics. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.